Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd come down with hidradenitis if you made me sweat with the idea that you missed today's show. Five questions. Heather Yando's article is Five Questions to Answer Before You Call a Consultant, and she'll help you avoid making a costly mistake. She's founder of Nonprofitist. And working virtually, we talk through the issues encountered when managing remote staff, technological, generational, emotional, measurement, recruiting, and retaining. Our panel is Heather Martin from Interfaith Family and Alice Hendricks with Jackson River. That originally aired November 2nd, 2018. On Tony's Take Two, our Innovators series. We're sponsored by Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. By Cougar Mountain Software, Denali Fund is their complete accounting solution made for nonprofits. Tony.ma/Cougar Mountain for a free 60-day trial. And by Turn 2 Communications, PR and content for nonprofits. Your story is their mission. Turn-2.co. It's a pleasure to welcome Heather Yando to the show. She is founder of Nonprofitist, an online resource that helps pair nonprofits with the right consultants. She's also a lead consultant at Third Space Studio, where she helps with strategic planning, board and leadership development, and going from good to great. Previously, she was director of development and communications with the North Carolina Conservation Network. Her consultancy is at thirdspacestudio.com, and Nonprofitist is at nonprofit.ist. Welcome to the show, Heather Yando.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you. You're welcome. You're welcome. so you are a consultant. Can I guess that people have made mistakes in, made mistakes by hiring you. No, that's not what I want to say. Scratch the opening clause of that sentence. But people can make mistakes in their consultant hiring if they're not thinking ahead.
That's absolutely right. Folks can make really costly mistakes, and they can waste a lot of time, their time and consultants' time, by not really having these questions answered before they go into it.
Okay. Have you been in a situation where you felt the organization had not thought through enough what they really wanted, and it wasn't the right time to hire you?
Absolutely. What I see are a couple of different problems that are reflected in these questions. One that I see all the time, and others might see this too, is that people come without a clear understanding of how much they have to budget for some kind of engagement with a consultant. So we're talking about a project, and that project could be anywhere from 5 hours of my time to 25 hours of my time to 100 hours of my time.
Yeah.
Depending on how deep we want to go. And having a sense of budget is really helpful at the front end.
That's something that I ask. I do planned giving consulting. Mm. And before I do a proposal, I have to have a budget range at least. Not, it doesn't have to be a number, but I have to have an idea so that I know that the things we just spent the past hour talking about can be achieved with the budget that the organization has in mind.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if people are getting multiple proposals for this kind of work, which often happens and I encourage, it's really helpful to be able to compare apples to apples. So you're not just comparing on cost, because that's often not the most important variable. You're really comparing on approach, on personality fit, on culture fit, on all of these other variables that are going to give you a much better outcome.
Yeah. Okay. Very, very wise. All right. So you've been on both sides. You've been in a nonprofit and as a consultant. You've hired consultants when you were.
I have hired consultants, yeah. And I certainly over the past 9 years of serving as a consultant, I have had many of these conversations about getting to the proposal or the contract phase.
Well, I admire you putting this these thoughts down because I've been a consultant even longer, and I've never, I do these things implicitly, But to say to organizations, these are the things you should have in place, or these are the questions you should be asking internally before you get to start talking to the first consultant, I think that's valuable and helpful. So thank you for coming on. I'm glad you're here to explain.
Of course.
So the first thing you want, you don't want some vague plan like board development or a strategic plan. You want something more than that.
Yeah, the first question that I want you to answer is, what's the challenge you want to tackle? What's the question you want answered? What's the sticky thing that your organization has been having trouble with over the past few years? So there's two ways that I see organizations often go when they talk to consultants that are not helpful. One is what you just mentioned, which is they come with a very vague desire for a strategic plan. And when you ask why, the answer might be, well, because our old one ended last year and we need to do it again, which is somewhat helpful, but really doesn't tell you what's driving this desire to have these conversations. And I think that a lot of times these ideas of fundraising plans, marketing plans, board development plans, they're things that nonprofit leaders know they can ask for. They know that they're good things to have. But they don't give you much of a sense of what's actually driving the need for this, or what's kind of behind it. What are the questions keeping you up at night about this topic?
Yeah.
What are the things you really want to tackle through this effort? So one is being too vague. The other thing I see a lot when organizations talk to me is that they are really, really specific. So they have not only figured out that they want a strategic plan, but they have figured out every single activity that's going to happen over the next 6 months to make that happen. So they have designed a whole process without the aid of somebody like me who does this a lot and can really bring some of that outside expertise. So sometimes folks are also getting a little too specific, and oftentimes they're not really addressing the right challenge. So getting clear about that challenge can help us co-design something that would really address it.
Yeah. Okay. So it's two ends of the spectrum, either too vague or too specific in terms of precise tasks they want done. And they're really just hiring you to execute what they've developed. Yeah. I've never been in that situation. I've had the too vague, but not the too specific. Well, I work in planned giving, so it's such a black box. Unfortunately, it should not be. I'm constantly railing against that. It should not be a black box. It need not be a black box. But so I think people are not sure what activities to do in planned giving. But if it's...
That totally makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it shows up a lot in requests for proposals, which I'm actually writing an article now about how they're the worst and people should think about what else to do. But often in a request for proposals, it will be very, very detailed about all of the activities they want the consultant to undertake.
Yeah. Well, depending how precise it is, you may as well just have an employee do it.
Absolutely.
You developed it internally. You may as well just have the person who helped develop it to carry it out. If you're such experts in what the plan should be, why don't you go ahead and do it?
Yeah, right. And you're really not getting the bang for your buck of hiring an outside expert.
Yeah.
Because we really do understand the process around a lot of these conversations and how to structure them, how to really engage people, how to help you make change and make that change stick.
All right, we got to take our first break, Heather. When we come out of this in about 30 seconds or so, I want to dive into board development a little bit. Like what kind of specifics would you want to see there? And then we'll carry on with the rest of the questions.
Great.
So it's time for this break. Wegner CPAs, so that your 990 gets filed on time, so that your audit gets finished on time, so that you get the advice of an experienced partner, Yeet Uchtoom, been a guest on the show, and the full firm that has a nationwide nonprofit practice with thousands of 990s and audits under their belt. It's WegnerCPAs.com. Now let's go back to five questions. Okay, Heather. So instead of we want board development, what would you like to see? Like at what level would you like to see the plan fleshed out?
So what I would really love is for an executive director maybe a board chair to call and say, you know, we've done some thinking about our board. Maybe we've even done a little bit of an assessment of our board, and we've figured out we have these couple of challenges. We're really struggling with accountability around following through on tasks. Or we've done some training on fundraising, but the board still isn't really engaged. And then we can have a conversation from there about, well, what have you tried? What do you think's behind it? What might we try together to help the board shift in these particular ways? So the important pieces are that you've done some reflection about what the challenge might be and what's really behind that.
Yeah.
It's interesting you bring up board development, because that actually links into question number two, which is, does everybody agree that this is a challenge and that there's some need for outside help? So if we're talking about a board, the executive director might have a particular opinion. Does the board chair share that opinion? And if they don't both see the same challenges or even see a challenge with the board, then again, you're not setting up the consultancy for, you're not setting up this engagement for success.
All right. So does everybody agree about the challenge? So whether this even, like, what's the source of the trouble? Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. So if you as an executive director feel like the board really has trouble with accountability, or they don't understand their roles and responsibilities, does the board chair, who is really the leader of the board, have that same assessment? Would they agree? If I show up to do a training on roles and responsibilities, how is that going to be received by the board? Is everyone on the same page, or at least the leaders on the same page about what that challenge is?
Okay, I see. Yeah. So if it's let's continue with the example of board development. Do you want to know that the full board has formally approved it, but at least discussed the idea that, you know, we need some help here? You want to know about the full board, or really just like the executive committee, or what?
I think it depends on board culture. I would say more people buying in is always better.
Yeah.
So if there is a conversation among the full board about devoting 2 hours at our next meeting to this topic, to bring in an outside expert to talk about this, that would be ideal. That really sets me and any other consultant up for success.
And so I guess likewise, if there's some kind of staff, staff work that's going to be done, you'd want to know that the staff has bought into the idea. It's not just coming from the vice president or the CEO.
Absolutely. If you want to develop a fundraising plan, is your development team bought into the need to do this?
Have they
talked about what the challenges are and how whatever this fundraising plan is might help them move past those challenges? So it's really this kind of idea of who are the key stakeholders, and are they in agreement with this desire to have an outside expert come in? Are they in agreement about the challenge at hand?
Okay. Yes, the key stakeholders. Right. All right. So, yeah, driving home the point that there's got to be conversations internally before we start talking to somebody externally. We got to know what our trouble is, and
that's right.
And the key people need to be invested in the process to solving the problem. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Now I want to let you know that I let you subtly go from question one to two. Without my buy-in, it's okay. Let's just tread lightly as we go forward. Okay.
All right.
So your next one is the timing. When do you want the project?
Absolutely. So this is really important, because oftentimes the timing really impacts when a consultant is able to help or not. So if you want a board retreat next Saturday, I may not be able to help, or even next month. Someone may be booked up. If you already have really important dates for that project on a calendar and a consultant isn't available, you may have to move on to another person, or you may have to shift the timeline if that's really the right person. So there's one question about specific dates on the calendar. The other question is just what's really driving the timeline for the organization? Do you need this to be done by a certain date because there's a grant deadline, there's turnover on your board, there's something else externally driving it? So at the front end, really thinking through where does this fit in terms of our schedule can be really helpful in figuring out in that first phone call, is this consultant a good fit? And what might need to be shifted to make them a good fit?
You know, as well, there has to be some receptivity for the consultant to push back and say, you know, that's not a realistic timeline for the scope of the work that we're talking about, you know, putting aside it's, you know, a board retreat on a weekend or at a board meeting, but, you know, a longer term engagement, like for instance, you know, planned giving, there's not much we can do in planned giving in 6 months. I don't agree to 6 month engagement. It's got to be at least a year. You have to be willing to hear that what we've just talked about can't be done in the timeline that you defined.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I think I would say 90% of the folks I talk to have a overambitious timeline.
Oh, yeah.
And when we really start to dig into what are all the tasks that need to be accomplished, who are all the people that need to be engaged, what are all the schedules that need to be managed, oftentimes we're having that same conversation. And I believe, as you probably do, that particularly for these bigger processes where you're really, in terms of plan giving, building something new, doing a lot of research, having these important conversations, it just takes more time. And that's important because it also means that it's more likely to stick if you are having more conversations over more time. So when I do strategic planning, I really like for that to have a 6 or 9 month time horizon. That gives people enough time to really think through all the implications of any changes we're making, gives the board and the staff opportunities to engage with each other in different ways. So yes, pushing back on the timeline is really important too.
Now, strategic planning, I would think, I don't do that kind of consulting at all, but there are interviews that have to take place and you coordinate with people's schedules, you know, which board members just started a new business. So she's going to be in Costa Rica for 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a particularly strategic planning. I mean, I would think that's a particularly long time frame. And then and you have to be willing to recognize that it may not be finished even in the time that we have defined.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. All right. So before we rush through to points number 4 and 5, I'm putting you on the spot about a bit. Tell us a story, something that maybe when the initial conversation took place, they hadn't thought through it enough, and you advised them that they do some internal thinking, and then you did come in and you were genius, and they paid you double what the contract amount was. Anything like that where the internal work made a big difference. You could tell.
Yeah, I wish I had that story where they paid me double. I don't have that story.
You haven't been consulting long enough. Oh, I have a dozen of those. Oh man, I have a dozen of those. But I've been consulting since 2003. 17 years.
Oh, there you go.
Stay at it. You'll get there. You'll get there. Keep at it.
What I have is more of the lesson learned in failure, the cautionary tale.
Okay.
Particularly early on in my consulting career, kind of blindly believing one person's viewpoint of the state of an organization and not truth checking that other key stakeholders.
All right, what happened?
And an executive director called for some work with their board. The board was having some big problems with getting work done. Committees weren't really functioning very well. They weren't doing their fundraising. Things that a lot of organizations are dealing with. I often hear some similar complaints. And so we talked about doing a half-day board retreat where we developed some action plans on how to get these things back on track. And I discovered upon getting into the board retreat that the board did not see these as problems. Mm. And that if I had done some more conversation or even some assessment survey work with the board, I would have discovered that they had a very different viewpoint of what the challenges were. And they were in some level of conflict with the executive director about whose work was this, how they wanted to be encouraged and stewarded as volunteers of the organization. And so it was a real lesson for me of that question number two, has the board chair and the executive director, have they talked about this? Are they in agreement? Does everyone see this challenge from the same viewpoint?
That sounds like it may have become... Well, hopefully not tense, but at least awkward while you were in front of the board.
It was definitely awkward. It was definitely awkward. We recovered and they did some good work. But
that's good.
It was, I learned definitely that I needed to have a more comprehensive understanding of organizations before I do that kind of work.
Yes, not one person's perception. All right. Was the executive mm-hmm. director in the room while this was unfolding?
She was,
yeah.
And we had some good conversations afterwards. You know, it wasn't terrible, but it really did draw more of a bright line of this is what you thought was going on, and this is what the board thinks is going on, and they're different, and we need to talk about why and how we can deal with both.
Okay, good that it was early on in your career. This was just not last week, was it?
It was not last week.
Okay. So you're going uphill. That's good. That's good.
That's right.
Okay. Your next one is around money.
Yes. Yeah, so we already talked about this a little bit, that it's so important on the front end to have an understanding of what your budget is for any work, not only for all the reasons we already discussed, but also because it really signals to a consultant and signals to your organization that you're serious about addressing the challenge. So if you have money built into the budget, or if you go back to the board and have them approve a revised budget with a little bit more funding for some kind of special project throughout the year, it also signals to everyone that this is a serious issue and we're going to devote some resources to it. Plus, super useful for us as consultants to know what we're dealing with and if it's even possible, as you said.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, your point earlier, I want to reemphasize, if you're getting proposals that run the spectrum of costs, then you're not really making fair comparisons.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely have seen organizations who, particularly for these catch-all terms like strategic plan, will get a $5,000 proposal and a $50,000 proposal, and they're just not comparable.
Yeah. And then you end up wondering, well, okay, let's say we could spend the $50,000, but what would the $5,000 person have done if we told them our budget was $50,000? Because we like what they're doing for $5,000, but it's not nearly as comprehensive, obviously. Gee, what would they have done for $50,000? And then you got to go back to them, and you know, or we can only spend $25,000, and so neither one is quite right. You know, that's a big botch. That's a big time waste, time suck. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Be upfront. And there is a responsibility on consultants too, I think, to ask if money hasn't come up, you got to ask, what are we looking at? What kind of budget do you have?
Absolutely. Having that money conversation. And I tend to do it even earlier in the conversation now, because what I find is that we can daydream about all of the wonderful things we could do together. And then when they say, and we have $10,000, I have to sometimes reel some of those things back in, or they have to make hard choices about all of the potential beautiful options I put out on the table. So I'm even now early in the conversation asking folks so that we can really right size, or I can present options in a way that helps people understand what's possible.
Okay. Okay. Let's go to your last question. What do you got? You introduce
it. It's the last question, but I think it might be the most important one. And that's, how much organizational time and energy do you have to address this challenge? So what's the bandwidth for this piece of work? A lot of times, and you may see this too, organizations think, well, I have a problem, so we're just going to throw money at it. We're going to hire a consultant, and they're going to hear our woes and go off and fix it and come back and present us with a perfect plan to solve all of our problems. That's not realistic. Yeah. I don't believe that's how consultants who want to really make lasting change in organizations often operate. So we always need organizational help. We need board time. We need staff time. We need, if we're in the case of fundraising, we need some reports from your database. We might need to look at, sit down with you and really go over your last strategic plan and think about what worked and didn't and why. But we're definitely going to need the executive director's bandwidth and then those other key stakeholders. Yeah.
Go ahead. No, you finish. You finish. I'll remember mine.
So just getting clear about, do you have the bandwidth? And if you are trying to do a huge capital campaign and move the office and you've got transition of a key staff person, or you're hiring a whole set of people because you're ramping up for the election, if there are other organizational priorities going on, sometimes I'll say to folks, it seems like this isn't the right time to tackle a big project, that you really don't have the bandwidth. You've got some other competing priorities.
That often gets in the way of the final step, engagement, because
yeah.
other things are coming up. There's a database conversion. There's a gala, et cetera. It's valuable, too, to talk about, I think, at the granular level, how much time this is going to take, at least in my work. You know, I need a staff person and I'll need maybe 4 to 5 hours a month of their time or something, you know, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So that they know what, so that they can plan around, you know, everything you just said, just getting a little more granular with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I will often, as we're talking through, really think about what's the board time and attention we might need, what's the staff time and attention we might need. And really thinking about how does that fit in with what you already have going on over the course of the year? Can we find an hour at this board meeting and 3 hours at the board retreat to do this work? Or is your plate already full for this year? And that might be okay.
Okay. Final thought, Heather, before we wrap up. We just got about a minute left.
So the final thought is all of these point to being really intentional about the conversations you have internally before you pick up the phone and call a consultant. Really thinking through what's our challenge, how many resources do we have to devote to this, what our time is we can devote to this. That's just going to be, you're going to get much better proposals from consultants and in the end, a better engagement and a better product.
Heather Yendo, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure, Heather. She's founder of nonprofit.ist, nonprofitist, and her consulting is at thirdspacestudio.com. We need to take a break. Cougar Mountain Software, their accounting product, Denali, is built for nonprofits from the ground up so that you get an application that supports the way you work, that has the features you need, and the exemplary support that understands how you work. They have a free 60-day trial on the listener landing page at tony.ma/Cougar Mountain. Now it's time for Tony's Take Two, our Innovators series. It just finished last week, and I curated the 8 innovators into one post. So we started way back in January with Edgar Villanueva, that was Decolonizing Wealth, and Stephen Myers with Personalized Philanthropy. And it was back then in those dark days of January that I had to assure you that live innovators were coming. And they did come. We started off with Heather McLeod Grant. That was Social Change is System Change. And the innovators have been live ever since her. Peter Shankman, Sherry Quam Taylor, Peter Heller, Jamie Burse, and Chris Field. They make up our Innovators series. You will find them curated, cataloged, and captured with a video at TonyMartinetti.com. And that is Tony's Take Two. Now, here is the pre-recorded Working Virtually. Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of 18NTC. It's the Nonprofit Technology Conference 2018. We're coming to you from the Convention Center in New Orleans. The second interview of the second day of our coverage. All our NTC interviews are sponsored by Network for Good, easy-to-use donor management and fundraising software for nonprofits. My guests right now are Heather Martin, COO of Interfaith Family, and Alice Hendricks, CEO of Jackson River. Heather, Alice, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to Nonprofit Radio. Pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
How's the conference going for you, ladies?
It's great.
Have you done, yeah?
Excellent.
Okay, great and excellent. Those are good superlatives. Have you done your session yet?
We did. We were on yesterday morning.
Okay, so it's all relaxing now.
Right. Yep, now we're just partying.
Yes, drinks last night. No
right,
problem.
Exactly.
Okay, all right. Your workshop topic is Working Virtual, Attracting and Managing the Best Talent. I'm sure we have stats on how many orgs, nonprofits have virtual employees, or at least what the trends are. It's obviously growing, right?
It's Otherwise, definitely growing.
It wouldn't be here.
And not only in the nonprofit world, in the for-profit world as well, and especially in tech.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. It's becoming, because of the technology that can enable easily to work from home,
sure.
Chat technologies, video conferencing, it's become a thing, and everyone is doing it now and exploring whether it works for their organizations a lot.
Let me dive into the word everyone, not to quibble with you at all, but I was thinking of generationally, are there 50 and 60-somethings that are comfortable working? Being virtual. Maybe we'll get to whether they're comfortable having virtual employees.
Right.
Maybe we'll get to that. My voice just cracked like I'm 14. We'll get to that. But how about being virtual employees themselves? Are they comfortable? I'm over 50, so I'll include myself in that. Are we comfortable doing that or not too much?
I think it actually depends on the organization, and it's really dependent on the organization making the employee comfortable. And so I'm not sure, I don't know if you have any stats, but I don't know from an age perspective. There's a very good question about an older generation being comfortable having virtual employees under them and managing them.
We'll come to that.
However, as being the virtual employee, I think it's all about how the organization sets it up.
Okay, excellent. All right, so there's promise then for those 50 and 60-somethings.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Let's talk about it since we're skirting around it. How about comfort or discomfort with having employees being virtual when you're over 50?
So, I think that there might be an age discrepancy in the comfort. I also think it's just personality. And I'm finding that when I talk to a lot of people who are looking to work virtual and they're asking me, what can I do to go to my manager, my supervisor, and quote-unquote sell them on me working virtually, my answer to them is find out what the resistance is. There's part of the resistance is we've always done it this way. I need to see my employees to know that they're working.
Yeah.
And how do you get around that? Some of the key things that we talked about in our session are setting very clear goals and making sure that those goals are being met.
Let's go to Alice. Talk, flesh out the goal setting a little more.
Yeah, I think that there's not that much difference in terms of goal setting in terms of accountability for deliverables that you're supposed to be doing. So you... The real issue is communication, making sure you have a structure where there's frequent communication and proof that you're doing the deliverables. So you're measured not on a punch clock style of I get to work at 9 and I leave at 5 and therefore I must have worked during that 8-hour period. You're measured based on what is the work you were set out to do and did you actually do that work in the time period I said I would do it. So if you're a project manager or working on a program area, you work with your supervisor on here are the things that I'm going to get done at a particular time, and if that's not done, that could be a concern.
Fine.
That's
a
problem, but that'd be a problem in a non-workplace too. But rather than time, it's mostly based on work product.
Okay. So, and that should apply even if you don't have any virtual employees.
I think one of the things we found is that working virtually is the same, or managing virtually is the same as managing in an office, but you just have to be much more intentional about what you're doing, much more intentional about your communication, understanding that you're not going to have that water cooler conversation, that someone's not going to overhear something and understand where you are in a project and be ready to communicate with those people who are not physically in the office. But the management and the psychology of the management is very similar.
Okay, that's very interesting. That's valuable to know.
and make explicit. Yeah. How about attracting people to a virtual org? Attracting the right talent so that we're comfortable that they're going to work in this work environment. What are your thoughts, Alice?
Well, there's two thoughts on that I have. One is that
you're looking at each other like, who's going to call on?
one is that your talent pool is the entire country or world, should you see fit, and there are wonderfully talented people in places that aren't in the city or town in which your organization is located.
Yeah.
And it gives you this ability to recruit from a wide place. And you can also hire incredibly talented people from who have a wonderful lifestyle in a less cost of... In my organization, we have people who live in a lower cost of living state than Washington, D.C., where we're based. And that allows me to provide a living wage for my employees in that... But the other thing is just... When you're recruiting, you have to be very mindful of the interview process. And I think one of the things we talked about in our session was helping people figure out who these folks, how well they'll respond to working virtually.
How do you do that in an interview?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Who's best at that?
Heather.
So some of the things that we recommend, some of the things that we recommend is, number one, we use technology as a tool to enhance communication in a virtual environment. So sometimes you're using video conferencing just for a regular meeting, and you're talking through Instant Messenger, and there's other ways you're using technology. So in the interview process, I always recommend that people use the technology that you're going to require those employees to be using during their job.
Yeah, yeah.
If they can't do an interview on Skype or Zoom or a peer-in, and it's very uncomfortable, it's not to say that might not be a good employee for you, but you have to be aware that there might need to be some training or development on that tool for them. And going into that is important when you're hiring that person.
And if you see generally a discomfort with technology, that's a pretty big red flag.
A red flag that you might need to overcome, or that person's not right for the position. And then the other question is, some positions just don't lend themselves to working virtually. And you have to be aware of that when you're hiring also.
What are some?
Well, one of the easiest ones that we look at is if you're an office manager and you're managing the physical office space, it's really difficult to be virtual when you need to notice that there's a crack in the ceiling or the vendor needs to deliver something and be there for
them. I was thinking, we don't have a tool for measuring the coffee level.
Right,
remotely. In the cabinet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, remotely. Okay.
There's an app for that. You can probably.
Okay.
It's time for our last break. Turn 2 Communications. They're former journalists, so that you get help building relationships with journalists so that your call gets answered when there's news you need to be on top of so that you stay relevant in your community. They are at turn-2.co. We've got buttloads more time for working virtually with Heather Martin and Alice Hendricks.
Any others that stand out to you as...
I think it depends on the industry and what the job you're doing. If you're someone who does intake or you have to be there to welcome people into the office, you need someone physically there. There may be hybrids, where sometimes people could work in the office and sometimes people could work from home. And I think thinking this through before you move to a virtual environment or virtual job for that specific role is key. You can't just say, okay, tomorrow we're just going to go virtual.
Yeah, yeah. So, Alice, how do you create this environment that's going to be hospitable to virtual?
I mean, it's all about culture. You have to create a culture where everyone is communicating well with each other, where people know what the expectation is on response times of communication.
So it's got to start at the top then.
It has to start at the top.
There has to be a willingness at the CEO level.
Absolutely.
To accommodate virtual employees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it starts there. And then how does the CEO trickle it down?
You adhere to it. So rather than walking from my office into someone else's office and telling them what I think they should know, that maybe two other people who aren't physically there also need to know, I will do that on a Slack channel, for example. So I'll use an Instant Messenger chat program, and I'll put them all on the channel and talk to them all together at once.
Even though two of them are
even if that's the situation.
Within 25
because it requires amount of discipline, because you don't want to leave people out. The interstitial conversation that happens at the water cooler can also be done virtually, and that's pretty important too.
Okay, excellent. All right, we're going to get to tools, because you mentioned Slack, a Slack channel. Is that a tool?
Yeah.
Okay. A chat. It's a simple chat.
It's a chat. Chat software,
okay. You're over my head. But I'm trainable. I'm trying. I could be a virtual employee. Trust me.
Yeah, we might have some technology challenges there, but we can get you there, I think.
I'll be the remedial.
You got
employee.
The radio but stuff
only,
down.
Only for, yeah, I'm very good at that. I mean, I got knobs and everything in front of me, buttons and all. Yeah, I don't know what they do, but okay. What else? Anything else about creating the environment, making it hospitable?
I think some of the things.
Anything more?
Some of the other things are making sure that your remote employees have the tools, whether it's the technology or even a monitor to go along with that laptop that you've given them. Because some people go into a new job, they're given a laptop, they say work from home, and it's not as easy as just, is your home office conducive? And being able to help them think through what are the things that they need to set up in a virtual environment to make them successful and effective at what they're doing. We talk about a little bit about security and knowing what the security measures are. You can't go into a coffee shop and work from your computer. Number one, are you on the Wi-Fi? Are you on the public Wi-Fi?
Yes.
Are you
oh
on
my
a
gosh.
Virtual private network? Are you using your hotspot? Well, you have to go to the bathroom, and your computer is sitting in Starbucks. Do you leave it there and ask the person next to you to watch your computer while you go to... I mean, we set policies around these things, especially in organizations that have a lot of regulations on data and accessibility for their information. These are things you have to think about when you're creating a virtual environment.
Okay. Yeah, it could be HIPAA. It could be, what's the credit card, PCM?
PCI.
PCI.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do you do when you're at Starbucks alone? You're on a VPN, virtual private network, but you have to go to the bathroom. You got to close up your laptop.
You use the diaper changing table and you pull it down in the restroom and put your laptop on that.
Okay.
Take care of your business.
Okay. This is very interesting. All right, no, I love the nitty gritty. This our listeners.
I mean, we're all about real life here.
Yeah, we need the detail. All right, so you need clear policies around
written policies that people sign, and everyone is very well aware of what the security policies are.
Data protection, use of technology,
yep.
Use of the companies versus your personal mm-hmm. technology, home versus away from home. Okay,
yep. mm-hmm.
yeah. All right, help me out here. Anything else? What else belongs? I'll just ask you. What else belongs in our policy?
There's communication policies.
Thank
how,
you.
I mean, one of the things that we found when we first started having more virtual employees, we started as an in-office. Everyone was in the office, and as we grew into different communities, we had employees in different cities and states than our headquarters were located in. And things like when I send an email, I just need you to acknowledge that the email was sent. If you're in the office and I send you an email and you haven't responded, I could walk into your office and say, hey, did you get my email? Even if you're not ready to respond to it, I know you've gotten it, and by 5 o'clock that day, I'll get an answer.
Yeah. All right.
When someone's virtual and you send an email, you have no idea if it like got lost, did it go into their spam, and you have to get some kind of communication
going.
You
just want a quick got it.
So we set a communication policy that says if I asked you something or requested something, you send an email back saying, I got it, and I'll get back to you by Wednesday. Period, the end, it's all set. And so that you need to be very much more aware of those types of things.
Yeah, it's
and
the other intentionality awareness that you said you talked
right.
about earlier.
So we have communication policies that go along with that.
Okay. Alice, you want to add to our policy statement at all?
I mean, the security, I think, is the most important. You know, the email security, the hacking potentials. You know, what happens also when someone is let go? The lockout procedures, they have access
excellent.
To all of your
excellent.
Systems. And they're, you know, in North Dakota somewhere at a coffee shop. You have to shut down all of their access to things. So all of that needs to be planned at the IT level in the company. What are you going to do and how are you handling staff with remote devices?
Can we do this if we don't have a dedicated IT staff person?
Yeah, we don't have a dedicated IT staff
okay,
person.
Excellent.
Yes. It's
interfaith. So the interfaith family says the answer is yes. Okay. Because we're small and mid-sized nonprofits in this audience
yep.
of listeners. So
you onboard someone with technology. When they leave, you do the same thing, only with a virtual person. You don't physically have them there. And so you have to do the same thing you would do if someone was in the office, but make sure you can do it while they're not physically there. How do they get their computer back to you? Do they FedEx it to you? Are you going to go pick it up somewhere if they're not there? And so just those types of things need to be thought through.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. I love the policy statement details because this is stuff you have to think through. And then, Alice, to your point, you know, it has to be activated, implemented on, and from the top.
Absolutely.
You can't just have a policy and ignore it. You know, if it's the CEO, I don't know, I'm trying to think, if it's a C-level person who's distant, you know, they too have to say, I got your email, and I'll get back to you by Wednesday.
Everybody
you know,
has to play by the same rules.
Yeah.
There shouldn't be exceptions or any accommodations for anything else,
Okay. Let's talk about some of the needs that your remote staff has. We've been talking a little about like managing the office. What special needs do the people who we only see a couple of times a year have?
That's a great question.
Alice? Oh, thank
you. I mean,
you.
I think they
we're
need...
We're halfway in. It took that long, but all right. I'll take it. All right.
I mean, they need community. They need a partner. They need a buddy. They need to know that they're not all alone. So frequent meetings, daily stand-up calls, and Heather's organization, they do...
What's a stand-up call?
It's a phrase for a daily time when you just spend 15 minutes sort of going around the company saying who's doing what that day, or a team if you're working on a project together.
Okay.
You know, everyone's together on either a video chat or a conference call, or it could even be on a Slack channel or a Skype group or a Google Hangout or any type of technology that people can come together for a period of time. The more frequent that happens, the more connected they feel. And there is an issue of feeling lonely. It's not that you're just going off in your back room and typing all day long on your own. You need to be part of a community and part of a team, and the technology helps enable that. And at Heather's organization, a buddy?
So anyone who is new who comes on board, there's a couple things we do. One is, no matter what level you're at, you come to Boston for a couple days to onboard. So you actually see physical people.
That's probably essential.
It's really, it was one of my key learnings when I started working virtually, to know that there's a physical person and a physical space, or just meeting someone face-to-face gives you much more of a connection to them immediately. The other thing we do is when we hire people, we give them a partner. So we hire an associate director in L.A., and we put them with the associate director in Atlanta. This is not a mentor. This is not a supervisor. This is someone you can ask the dumb questions to. Like, how do I get my expenses paid? Or, I'm sure they told me this during orientation, but I don't know what to do about X, Y, and Z. And just having that person that you know you can go to is critical, especially when you're by yourself in an office or in your home, and you're trying to go up the learning curve of starting a new job.
Okay. All right. What else? Anything else to be empathetic to our remote employees?
Again, this is a typical management. I would say this, you should be doing this anytime, is just everyone's intent is good. Assume that it's good, and there's a good intent all the time.
That could be that's going to have implications for chatting,
anything,
email. You know, you'll never hear but most of the communications, you're not going to hear the inflection in the person's
voice.
You don't see the physical.
You don't get the inflection. And so before you jump into anything, someone sends me an email and says, I need blank. Well, that can be taken in so many different ways. Are you demanding something from me? Did I not get you something? Like, there's so much in just those three words. And so my first thing is they have good intentions. Let me follow up. You need blank by when? What is this for? Like, get more information. They're not... Now, they could be like, you haven't done something.
Yeah,
I need it now.
They could be screaming at
you.
But the default is...
The default is not to do
intention.
That. And what we do, actually, is we have everyone create a communications charter that says how they like to be interacted with.
Oh.
And so I understand if you are one of these people who sends very short emails. I also have the flip side where someone sends me 7-paragraph emails to describe one thing. And so if I understand how you interact, I could read that email with that understanding, not to immediately assume that you're yelling at me in the email.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Okay. Very valuable. Anything else? Anything else to be supportive or again, empathetic to the remote employees? Or if we covered it, we covered it. But I want to make sure we...
The only other thing I can think of is definitely getting together at least once a year with the whole team.
At least
the culture building.
At least once. I'm not even sure.
It's tough in a nonprofit environment where you've got a very tight budget. But we have prioritized an all-in-person meeting in Boston. So we've got staff in California, in Chicago, in Atlanta, in Philadelphia. We make sure that we try in our budgeting process to bring everyone to Boston for 2 days during the summer, not only for good brainstorming and thinking and strategy conversations, but also so they can connect with each other and have that community and build that in-person conversation and feel comfortable with each other.
Yeah. And you feel like once a year is sufficient?
You know, if I had the budget to do it more, I
would. Or
you would
do it a little longer, but...
So you have to take it for what it's worth. One of the tools that we talk about is the airplane. I mean, yes, it's expensive, but it's a really helpful tool to really get past some of the boundaries that are put up when you don't actually physically meet in person.
Alice, do you have virtual employees also at Jackson River?
Yeah, 30.
30 remote
employees? The entire organization is virtual.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a physical office?
There is a physical office with 3 people in Washington, D.C. That's
okay.
it.
10%.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But so we all behave as if we're virtual. And there are many days that I don't go into the office. So, and it's, you know, it saves a lot of money in transportation costs. It saves dry cleaning bills for everyone. It saves childcare expenses. Yeah. It, you know, it's a very great way to have a lifestyle because you have that flexibility. There's also downsides to it. There are days that I wake up in the morning at 6 a.m. and check email, and all of a sudden it's 2 and I haven't eaten breakfast yet, and then I'm on till 6 at night. So, you know, it's the same type of work-life integration needs to happen in a virtual environment as well as a physical office space. You know, you need to know how to take a break.
You mentioned saving childcare expenses. So the remote employee, it needs to be understood that the remote employee may not be immediately accessible, right, for a last minute. You know, we got to talk right now.
So I think
but
it's
they
about
they might have something going on that is going to hold them up for 10 or 15 minutes.
We try and make sure that people have adequate coverage to do their job during the day, the hours that they need to work. So we have a lot of employees that are at 30 hours a week because they want to spend more time with their families. Older children can be met at the bus stop and take care of themselves for a few hours in the afternoon. But the expectations of performance are still there. You know, we are pretty high, have high standards of that. You know, we don't want you to be distracted from your work.
How do you manage the West Coast versus East Coast? Do the West Coast people have to start at 6 a.m. local time?
I think a lot of people do different policies on that. Our policy is that you work for the day, the business day in the time zone in which you live. So it's sometimes hard if we're dealing with Europe and the West Coast at the same time because the time zones don't overlap as well.
Do you have employees in Europe?
We don't have employees in Europe, but we do have clients in Europe.
Okay.
So it's a situation where we do have to manage that. But there are organizations that have West Coast people working East Coast hours.
There are, yeah. Do you have that issue?
We don't have an explicit policy that you work those hours, but we ask people how early, on the West Coast, how early would you be willing to have a meeting? So we will not set meetings with some people. Some people are early morning people, and they would rather work from 7 to 3 rather than 9 to 5. And so we'll work with your schedule individually. And so there are some meetings I will have on the West Coast at 7 o'clock in the morning, but that's due to that person willing to do that meeting.
Yeah. We have a few minutes left still. Let's talk about some of the tech tools. Alice, I got to ask you about Slack. Slack.com, how do we find it? What does it do for us?
Slack.com is how you find it. You know, it's equivalent to Skype, or there's Google Chat, any type of chat software where everyone can log into, and then you can make groups in them. So the term for a group in Slack is called a channel. And in our organization, we have a channel for, one of the channels is named Lunch. And if you're going to be away for 20 minutes or going to lunch, we just Slack everyone who's in the company on that channel and say, hey, stepping away for a bit. I'll be back in half an hour. So we are all it's almost as though you would see me walk out the door, you know, and instead of walking out the door, I'm just telling that channel what's happening.
Yeah.
There's channels for each project. Also, Slack is a good one. Skype is a good one.
Slack is already a verb. You Slack someone.
You Slack someone.
It's a verb already.
Well, you Skype someone. You chat someone. Do you remember AOL Instant Messenger? That was a one.
I've
you might have used
about
that one.
Right? Yes. Yeah, I've heard rumors
you
that
could
one.
Use that
I was
too.
Never AOL. I was Hotmail. But okay, so Slack for chatting, quick chat. How about document sharing? Is it as simple as Google Docs, or is there something better?
It's as simple as Google Docs.
As simple as Google
Microsoft
Docs.
Has a great pro. We use Microsoft products,
we use,
right?
Microsoft's OneDrive, SharePoint, Microsoft Suite has a document sharing software, a cloud-based saving system. Skype for Business is integrated with it, and so we're using that in the office. And then there's a ton of independent ones out there, and it's whether it's video conferencing, or it's document sharing, or it's chatting. There's a ton out there, and I think it could be overwhelming. And for us, it was evaluating what was best for our organization and what our upper management was able to use. We talked about this before: is modeling the behavior you want from your staff, and so getting upper management on board was key. So one of our project management softwares we use Asana. And we've tried 3 or 4 of them, and our CEO liked Asana. And so if she was going to use Asana, we're all going to use Asana.
Yes.
And so I think that's really important. Yeah. It's got to be easy to use and work for your organization.
Okay. Calendaring? simple as Google
Calendar?
Shared
calendaring, yeah.
You have any other tools besides Google Calendar?
We're using Outlook's calendar.
Outlook, yeah. Okay. Microsoft again.
Yeah.
All right.
I think
what other categories do we need to...
Video chat. Video is really important.
You mentioned Skype a couple times.
You can do video with Skype. You can do video with Google Hangouts. But anytime you can actually have an opportunity to see someone's face. And most of the calls we try to do as videos. And we find that that works really, really well.
You prefer, yeah. All right. Again, the sense of community. Mm-hmm.
And if you can't get together, that's almost the next best thing. And video has come a long way. The technology is more seamless than ever before.
Yeah.
And so at least you're seeing the person. You might not get all of the nuance of the physical that's in the room.
Yeah.
But you can see an emotion or you can see a reaction to something, which is super helpful.
Right. Or their cat. Right. Walking across
the cat.
Their
we get a lot of pets walking in front of the camera while people are on video.
So this can be a lot of fun too. I mean, talking about cats, but you know, you have 30 virtual employees,
yep.
Alice. You have fun doing it? I mean,
oh, it's awesome. It's completely awesome. I love it. And yeah, you know, the best thing is that people have really formed strong relationships with each other. When you ask them what they like most about working here, is they say each other. They say the people. I'm here because I have connected relationships with other people on the team. And to be able to create a culture where people feel connected to each other in a remote environment is like, that's the thing I'm the most proud of anything we've ever done. It doesn't have to do with our software product or what we've done to impact nonprofits. Is the fact that we've had a culture of people that have had a wonderful time working and doing productive, impactful things.
Has Jackson River always had the largest proportion of employees virtual?
Yep.
From the beginning?
From the beginning.
So it was in the culture to start. Yeah.
Yep.
How about Interfaith Family?
We started as a 2.5-person organization in the same office.
Okay.
We got to probably about 8 to 10 people in the office, and then our growth took us into different cities and communities, and that's when we became virtual because of the growth. And so we're probably half in the office in Boston, and then half of our staff is outside, and there's one or two people in a city by themselves.
We're going to leave it there.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. They are Heather Martin, COO of Interfaith Family, and Alice Hendricks, CEO of Jackson River. This interview, sponsored by Network for Good, easy-to-use donor management and fundraising software for nonprofits. And this is Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of 18NTC. Ladies, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.
Real pleasure.
Next week, there's a good chance it'll be privacy best practices. And if that's not next week, it'll be coming very, very soon, and something else will be excellent next week. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. By Cougar Mountain Software, Denali Fund is their complete accounting solution made for nonprofits, tony.ma/Cougar Mountain for a free 60-day trial. And by Turn 2 Communications, PR and content for nonprofits, your story is their mission, turn-2.co. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Liebowitz is the line producer. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy. And this music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Do you run or are ready to open your own business? Hi, I'm Jeremiah Fox. I've been operating and opening small business for the last 25 years, and I'm the host of the new show, The Entrepreneurial Web. Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern Time for insights and stories on the nuances of running small business right here on Fridays at noon, talkradio.nyc.
I'm the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Fundraising, board relations, social media. My guests and I cover everything that small and mid-sized shops struggle with.
If you have big dreams and a small budget, you have a home at Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern at talkingalternative.com.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.